an Osho talk. Tao, the Golden Gate, talks on Koswan's The Classic of Purity, Volume 1, Number 2.
The first question. Could you say something about discipline and repression? They are as distinct as the earth and the sky. The distance is so much between the two that it is unbridgeable. Repression is just the opposite of discipline. But for thousands of years, repression has been misunderstood and thought to be as if it is discipline. It gives a pseudo appearance. And remember one thing, very fundamental, that the real is never in danger from the unreal. The real is always in danger from the pseudo. The unreal cannot harm it, but the pseudo can harm it, because the pseudo looks like it. It is not, and yet it has the mask of it, the appearance of it. Repression is cheap. Any stupid person can do it. It needs no intelligence to repress. Discipline needs great intelligence. Discipline means awareness. Discipline comes from your innermost core. It is not an imposition from the outside. Nobody can discipline you. The very word discipline is beautiful. It means the art of learning. Hence the word disciple. One who is ready to learn. One who is capable of learning. Learning is an inner process. One has to be always alert, only then one can learn. One has to be awake, only then one can learn. One has to watch all that goes on happening around you. And one has to deepen this watchfulness so that you can see even your inner processes of body, mind and heart. You have to become a mirror. You have to witness everything within yourself. Then only you learn from them, and that learning brings discipline. Then a deep harmony arises in you. Because whatsoever is wrong starts falling away from you on its own accord. You are not to drop it. If you have to drop it through effort, then it is repression. If it falls like dry leaves falling from the tree, then it is discipline. Discipline has to be effortless. It has to be out of sheer understanding. Repression has nothing to do with understanding, with learning. Others tell you what to do and what not to do. Others give you the 10 commandments. You have simply to follow. You have to be obedient. And who are these others? They are the powerful people, politically powerful, religiously powerful. They may be the rich people, the people who own the state or the church, the dominant people. They have their vested interests. To safeguard their vested interests, they create a certain kind of slavery, a mental slavery. They want people to be obedient. They don't want people to be rebellious. Hence, they cannot allow intelligence. Intelligence is basically rebellious. It is radical. It is revolutionary. To be intelligent is the most dangerous thing for those who are in power. Hence, every child has to be crippled and paralyzed. No child has to be allowed to live his life according to his light. Every child is born intelligent, but 25 years of conditioning from the primary school to the university. Creates a stupid person out of an intelligent child. So much conditioning that the intelligence disappears. He becomes so afraid to say no to anything. He becomes so afraid, so frightened of the crowd, that he simply follows like a sheep. He is no more a man. The only way to do it is teaching him how to repress himself. First he has to repress his intelligence, then he has to repress all that can be a danger to the status quo. For example, every society talks about peace but lives for war. Hence, sex has to be repressed, because sexually repressed people can be changed into soldiers very easily. There is no problem about it. The sexually repressed person is always ready to fight. He is always on the verge of violence. His sex becomes violence. He loses all tenderness, all loving qualities. and the instinct of love becomes perverted. It becomes the instinct for hatred. Up to now, all societies have been basically warring societies, always preparing for war. They cannot allow sexual freedom. If a society is sexually free and a person is allowed to live his sexuality totally, then his violence will disappear. Then he will not be ready to do such utterly stupid things as killing people for no reason at all. It will be impossible for him even to conceive. He will ask, why? Why should I kill? There seems to be no reason. Just because few power maniacs want to dominate the whole world, we have to be victims and we have to turn the whole world into a chaos. The sexually free person will be loving, tender. War will become impossible. Unless sex is free, war cannot disappear from the earth. All psychological research shows one thing very conclusively, that weapons are nothing but phallic symbols. Hence, societies which are preparing for war are bound to be repressive. Intelligence has to be crippled, sex has to be repressed. All that can make you capable of being an individual has to be discarded. You have to be forced to be a Christian, or a Hindu, or a Mohammedan, or a Jain, or a Buddhist, for the simple reason that if you are part of a crowd, you lose your individuality. You start functioning according to the collective mind. And the collective mind means the lowest mind. The collective mind functions through the lowest denominator. It is said that the best teacher in the schools, in the colleges, in the universities is one who can make himself understand, who can help the students to understand himself in such a way that the most mediocre student is also capable of understanding him. If only the first grade students understand him, he is not a good teacher. The third rate should be capable of understanding him, then he is a good teacher. But to make himself understood by the third rate, he has to fall that low. He has to be speaking the language of the mob, of the crowds, and the crowd consists of the mediocre people. It is because of centuries of conditioning. Otherwise, it would not have been so. It is a man-made calamity. So many people need not be so mediocre and stupid. They are not born that way. They are manufactured. Individuality has to be effaced, completely effaced. Because individuals, again, seem to be dangerous to the power holders. Because individuals will think and they will say yes only if they agree with it. Otherwise, they will say no. I have heard in the Second World War it happened many people were needed in the army, so all kinds of people were being recruited. Everybody was asked to sacrifice for the country, for the motherland, for the fatherland, and all that nonsense. A professor of philosophy was also recruited. The first day, the corporal calls the newly enlisted men for their first training and starts shouting, "Platoon, attention! Platoon, halt! Platoon, attention! Platoon, about face! Platoon, halt! Platoon, right face!" The professor steps out of formation and starts to walk away. "Hey, you!" shouts the corporal. "Where are you going?" "To the pub," said the professor. "I will come back when you have made up your mind." Naturally, a man who thinks will see the whole nonsense of it. What is the point of it? Why one should do all these things? But they have a certain reasoning behind it. This is how your intelligence is killed. This is how you are slowly transformed into a robot, into a machine. The man is slowly killed. Then you start functioning like a machine. Right turn, and you need not think. You simply turn right. Not that you think why. There is no question of why. No question arises in you. In fact, your body functions almost mechanically. Just like you push a button and the light goes on or off, or the machine starts functioning. When the soldier hears right turn, he simply turns right without paying any attention to what is being done by him. It simply happens. I have heard about William James, one of the most significant psychologists America has contributed to the world. He was sitting with a friend in a restaurant talking about conditioning. It was the talk all over the world, because just recently the Russian psychologist Pavlov has discovered conditioned reflex, that a man can be conditioned so deeply that he starts functioning like a machine. And Pavlov has become the father of Russian psychology. And communists have been following his ideas for all these 60 years. William James was talking to his friend, but the friend was not willing to accept the idea so easily. It was so new. At that very moment, a retired soldier was passing from the street with a bucket full of eggs to demonstrate. William James shouted, "Attention!" And the poor old soldier simply went into the posture of attention. The bucket fell. All the eggs were destroyed. He was very angry. He said, "Who has done this?" William James said, "But we had not said that you have to follow." He said, "It is no more a question of following. It has become my nature. Attention means attention. I have been in the army for 25 years. Attention means attention. It does not mean anything else. And it is not a question of my deciding whether to follow or not. It has become automatic." This is what all the societies have been doing, and all the so-called religions have been doing. They have been automatizing you. And this is done through the process of repression. Repress everything that can be dangerous to the establishment. That's why Jesus is crucified and Socrates is poisoned. And Al-Hillaz Mansur is killed. For the simple reason, because these people were bringing rebellion. These people were releasing others from their bondage, from their mental slavery. They were telling people to be intelligent, to be individuals, to be a light unto themselves. That's the message of Gautam the Buddha. Be a light unto yourself. Follow your own light. Follow your own intelligence. Don't listen to any wasted interest, because they are working for their own purposes. They have nothing to do for your welfare. They are not concerned about it. And once you repress anything, the energy that is being repressed, it starts turning sour in you. The same energy that would have become a flower becomes a thorn. The same energy that would have helped you to grow becomes stagnant, it starts stinking. Energy needs to remain in a flowing state. Repression makes your life stagnant. People's mental age is not more than 12 years. That means at the age 12, they have stopped growing psychologically. They may be 80 years old, but their minds are childish. Remember, not childlike, but just childish. It is beautiful to be childlike, but it is ugly to be childish. And why they have stopped at the age 12? For what reason? How it happens? And this is the average all over the world. It is the same in the East, in the West. It is the same for the Hindu and for the Christian. All the societies in their own ways have been able to repress everybody before the age 12. Why? Because the age 13 is the dangerous age. At that time, a person becomes sexually mature. Before that, all his growth has to be stopped. Once he becomes sexually mature, then it will be very difficult to repress him. He will have so much energy that all your measures for repression are bound to fail. So repression has to happen before 13. All kinds of nonsense have to be put in people's mind before they are 13. By the time they reach 12, the work should be finished. Then they will be growing only old, but not growing up. In an oral exam in biology, the teacher asks a student, which organ of man's body, once stimulated, can grow up to 300 times its size? The girl replies, I'm not going to answer such questions. And she walks out. So the teacher asks the same question to the following student who answers, the pupil of the eye. Very good, replies the teacher. Now go and tell your friend that she is going to be disillusioned. This is the work of repression. If you repress something, your mind slowly becomes colored by it. Everything becomes colored by it. A sexually repressed person is constantly concerned with sex. He may talk of celibacy. He may try to be a celibate, but his whole mind is full of sexuality. He dreams of sex and nothing else. And it is not so only when you are young. Mahatma Gandhi writes in his autobiography that even at the age of 70, he was suffering from sexual dreams. That is bound to happen. It is the 70 years repression. Otherwise, by the time one is 70, one should be mature enough to drop all these toys. Repression keeps things hanging in the air. The repressed person, even when he is dying, will be thinking of the thing that he has repressed his whole life. I am against repression. I am all for expression. Express yourself. Existence is God's expression. That's what creativity is all about. Express yourself. And don't condemn anything. Nothing is wrong with you. All that is beautiful. It may need transformation, but it is not wrong. It has not to be dropped. It has to be transformed. And transformation happens through discipline. Discipline comes through meditation. Become more aware, watchful. But don't carry conclusions, a priori conclusions. If you are already convinced that sex is wrong, then you cannot watch your mind. How can you watch if you have already concluded? Whenever a sexual thought will arise, you will shrink back. You would like to throw that idea out of your being. You will immediately jump upon it. You will start struggling and fighting. You cannot be simply watching. You will start evaluating. A meditator has to be absolutely unprejudiced, with no conclusions. He has to be an utterly scientific observer. He simply observes, take notes, whatsoever happens in your mind. Notice. Don't let anything go unnoticed, that's all. And the beauty of watchfulness is that whatsoever is meaningless, it starts disappearing on its own accord. And whatsoever is meaningful, it starts growing. Your energies start gathering around the meaningful. And they start deserting the meaningless. Then a certain discipline is born, not imposed by anybody from the outside. Many people, particularly Indians, write to me that why I am not giving a certain discipline to my sannyasins. I cannot. I am not their enemies. I am not in any way here to dominate anybody. I am not here to dictate. I can help you to understand. Then it is up to you, out of your understanding. If something happens in your life, good. But if it happens because I have said, then it is ugly. Then sooner or later, you will repent. Then sooner or later, you will take revenge with me. I am your friend. I can help you to be more alert. That's my whole function. And then whatsoever is good follows so silently, just like your shadow. It makes no noise and it does not give any ego to you. As you become more aware, all ego disappears. You become more and more humble, more and more simple, more and more ordinary. And that ordinariness is divine. That simplicity is sacred. But discipline has to arise in you. I can commune with you my understanding. I can share with you my experience. That's all. Then it is for you to decide what to do and what not to do. My sannyasins have to learn how to live in freedom. I know it is very difficult for you to. Even my sannyasins ask that if you give us definite rules, it will be easier for us to follow them. I know it will be easier because that's what you have been doing your whole life. Somebody has been giving you orders and you have been following. That has become your habit. You would like me also to be a father figure, just to tell you that this has to be done and this has not to be done. That makes things cheap and simple. You need not bother. You can simply depend on me, but that creates dependence and you lose something immensely valuable. You lose your freedom, you lose your independence, you lose your individuality, you lose yourself. And that is not my purpose here. My purpose here is to make you more and more unique individuals, more and more authentic individuals. I would like you to take the responsibility of your life upon your own shoulders, totally, so that you become completely free from all kinds of father figures. That brings great blessing and great benediction. The second question. Please say something to us about Swami Prem Chinmaya's death yesterday. And the first thing about Prem Chinmaya's death is that it was not a death at all. He died very consciously. He died so beautifully. It was rare. 10 years before, when he had come to me, I was afraid that he may die before he can taste something of deathlessness, because he was suffering from such a disease, it was incurable. But he was a rare individual. unique in many ways. He lived for these 10 years by simple strength of his individuality. His body was not capable to live. The doctors were puzzled. The physicians were unbelieving. But I knew the secret. He was not afraid of death. But he wanted to grow to a certain point before death happens. And he managed it. And the moment he was ready, I allowed him to go. I had to tell him that now you can drop your body. A deep communion has started between me and him. Because of illness, he was not able to come to see to me. And that's how sometimes blessings come in disguise. Because he was not physically able to see to me. Slowly, slowly, an inner communion was established. Day before yesterday, I called Sila in my room just to tell her that now it is time. Chinmaya can go. He is ready. Now there is no need for him to suffer any more in the body. He has done whatsoever was needful. He has attained to a certain integrity. Yes, he will be born once more. But that is a great achievement. He died from his 6th center. To attain to the 7th would have been almost impossible in such a condition. Even this was almost a miracle to achieve, to dare to from such a height. The moment Sila reached Chinmaya's room, he immediately said, "Had Bhagwan called you in his room?" She was surprised, because it is very rare that I call anybody into my room. In these 6 years, I may have called Sila only thrice. So it was not an everyday thing. And Sila may be the only one, besides Vivek and Lakshmi, who has been called to my room ever. But immediately he asked, "Has Bhagwan called you in his room? What he has said? What is his message?" A deep communion has started happening lately. And when Sila told him that now Bhagwan has said that you rest, relax, go deep into yourself and forget about the body. It was very difficult to forget the body because his body was in immense pain. It was not an ordinary pain. No painkiller was of any help. Great doses of painkillers were being given to him, but nothing was helping him. Even it was impossible to help him to go to sleep. The pain was so much that it was keeping him awake. He laughed and he said, "Yes, I will do it." Thrice in the night, again and again he asked Sila, "Please, tell me again what is the message of my master. I don't want to forget his message at the last moment." And whenever she said that he has said only three words, rest, relax, go deep into yourself, he said, "Yes, now I remember." He fell asleep again. He told Sila that he wanted to listen to this series, but at least he hopes he will be able to listen to the first lecture. And he managed. Yesterday he listened to the whole lecture. And fully conscious. With all that pain, he listened to the lecture. Then he asked for the last time about the message. And then he closed his eyes and disappeared. This is not death. This is something far more beautiful. This is let go. This is surrender. This is love. He trusted me so totally. He died beautifully, silently, in utter relaxation. I am happy about him. I was afraid that he may not be able to survive even these years, but it was his sheer determination, sheer willpower that he survived. The body would have been dead at least 6 years before. He lived for 6 years, a kind of posthumous existence. He would have still lived. At least for 3 months, he could have still managed. But I saw no point in it. Because whatsoever he has attained, more was not possible. In this body, the body was getting rotten, absolutely rotten. And he was in such a good space that I did not want him to get disturbed as far as his inner space was concerned. I wanted him to leave. There are moments when one should depart. He was in such a positive mood, in such a negative body. He was in such a healthy mood, in such an unhealthy body. Just the other day, when I was telling you a joke about Jesus and the man who was suffering from cancer, I was remembering of Chinmaya, and he was listening. And he must have laughed, because he loved jokes. The angels who must have carried him must be puzzled, because he has been at least 6 years late. Three Italians arrive in paradise. Saint Peter asks the first one, "Who are you?" "I am a Carletto from Milano." "Very well, you are on time, come in," says Saint Peter. Then he asks the second one, "And you, who are you?" "I am a Gennaro from Roma." "You are 6 hours late. How come?" asks Saint Peter. "Vela, San Pia, from Roma to here, it is a longer journey. I stop to rest a little on the way." "And you, who are you?" asked Saint Peter to the third man. "I am a Pasquale from Napoli." "Pasqua," says Saint Peter, "this is too much. You are 2 months late. Don't get angry. San Pier, I have been in bed sick. I don't know what Chinmaya is going to say, because 6 years is really too much. They may have completely forgotten about him. They will have to look in the files. It will take days for them to find out who is this man." But I think by now they must be becoming acquainted with orange people, that these are not reliable people. They come at all kinds of odd hours. They don't bother about time. They don't follow any rules. They don't know anything of discipline. He used to love jokes. He used to write me beautiful jokes. In his memory, I will tell few jokes to you. A man enters a fourth police station and says that his wife has disappeared. "When did she disappear?" asked the policeman. 5 or 6 years ago," he answers. 5 or 6 years ago?" exclaims the policeman. "Why did not you come earlier?" "Well, you see," says the man, "I just could not believe it." In Moscow, a communist chief sees an old man kneeling in front of an icon. He stops and asks him, "Are you praying, old man?" "Yes, I am praying," answers the old man. "You are praying for us, are not you?" "Of course." And you pray now for us, just as in the old times you were praying for the Tsar. That's true, replies the old man. Now tell me, were your old prayers of any use? Well, yes, they killed the Tsar, did not they? And this one he would like the most. It is a bank meeting. The president, heated by the discussion, gets up and starts pacing up and down. His secretary notices that his fly is open. So she whispers to him, "Mr. President, the garage is open. One can see everything." "Ah, yes. And what can you see? My new Mercedes?" "No," replies the secretary, "a Fiat with flat tires." Yesterday you celebrated his departure. Always remember him. He should be a light to you all. He loved deeply. He laughed deeply. He was a man who knows how to celebrate. Of course, the body was not willing at all. But he never bothered about the body. Yesterday he wanted to come to the discourse. I had to stop him. But still, he heard the whole discourse. And he said to Sila that, "I wanted to hear the whole series, but when Bhagwan says that I have to go, then I have to go. Then this is time. Then this is right time. And I don't want to miss it." He never wanted me to let down. He loved me tremendously. His name, Prem Chinmaya, means love and consciousness. He was both. He was love and he became consciousness. He died with a great love and with a great consciousness. It is not death at all, samadhi. It is transcendence of death. Soon he will be back. And whenever he comes, you will know. Because whenever I see that he is back in the womb of some of my sannyasin, I will call him Ko Suan, in the memory of this series of which he wanted to hear the whole but could only manage to hear the first lecture. So whenever I call any child Ko Suan, you will know perfectly well that Prem Chinmaya is back to fool around. The third question. My husband loves me so totally that he has never thought of another woman in his life. And we have lived together almost 25 years. I cannot believe it, although it is true. What do you say about it? I cannot believe it either. Once there was a man whose name was unbelievable. He was married to a very nice woman, and the two of them were a very contented couple. One day, unbelievable was so sick that he knew he was dying. So he called his wife and said to her, "Darling, I have spent my whole life being called by this idiotic name. Now that I am dying, please promise me one thing, not to put this name unbelievable on my gravestone. You can put a saying or a picture, anything, but not my name. I do not want to carry it into eternity." So the wife agreed. When he died, she put a saying on his gravestone which read, "Here lays a faithful husband who never betrayed his wife." From that day, people would pass by and read the gravestone and say, "It is unbelievable." Either your husband is dead, are insane. Or maybe you have stumbled upon a Buddha. But what a guy like Buddha is doing with you? At a beach resort, two friends are talking. Of course, all these young, almost naked girls are a constant temptation for our husbands, says one. "Maybe," replies the other. "But I trust mine absolutely. He is madly in love with me," I replies the first one, "and does not he ever have some sane moments?" If a man loves a woman, he is bound to love many other people too. Or if a woman loves a man, she is bound to love many people too. Because love cannot be confined to one person. If it exists at all, it cannot be confined. If it does not exist at all, then there is no question. Love is like breathing. If a person says that I breathe only when I am with you, and the remaining time I never breathe, you will not trust him. How can you trust him? He will be dead if he does not breathe when he is not with you. Love is the breath of your soul. But that's what we have done. For centuries, we have conditioned people to such stupid ideas and created so much misery in the world and so much jealousy and so much possessiveness and so much hatred for no reason at all. We have conditioned people with this stupid idea that love can only be from one person to another, one to one. If it is true, then it is one to one. Otherwise, it is untrue. Just the opposite is the truth. If it is one to one, it cannot be true. Then it is false, pseudo. Then it is only a make-believe. Then the persons are pretending. And they are being untrue to themselves, not only to the other person, but to themselves too. If a man is interested in beauty, how can he avoid not seeing beautiful women? And how can he avoid not being interested in them? The only way is to kill his interest in beauty totally. But then he is no more interested even in his own wife. That's what has happened. Because of this idiotic idea that love has to be one to one, love has disappeared from the earth. The only possible way to manage it is that the husband should not love the wife. He should kill the very instinct of love. He should repress the very idea of beauty. He should forget that beauty exists in the world. But then remember, he cannot love his wife either. Then he will pretend. Then he will go on acting empty gestures with no content. If a woman is told that you have to be only in love with your husband and you cannot even feel interested in other people, she is bound to lose interest in the husband. That's why husbands and wives lose interest in each other. They are constantly quarreling. They go on finding excuses to quarrel. But the real phenomenon is that they are quarreling because their love energies are not being allowed to flower. But they have forgotten about it because it is so ancient, the conditioning. Their parents were conditioned the same way and the parents' parents. It is coming from Adam and Eve's time. It has become so much part of us, almost part of our blood, bones and marrow, that we are not even aware of it. It has gone deep into the unconscious. So husbands and wives are constantly angry at each other, sometimes more, sometimes less, and always finding excuses to be angry. And they look sad. They are bound to be sad. They are bound to be angry. For the simple reason, all other excuses are false. I am not saying that they are knowingly falsifying. They are unaware of the whole phenomenon. The simple truth is that a man who is interested in beauty will remain interested in many women. A woman who is interested in beauty will remain interested in many men. Maybe she is more interested in one person. That is possible. Maybe she is so much interested in one person that she would like to live with that person. But that does not mean that her interest in other people simply disappears. It remains. But if you are going with your husband or with your wife for a morning walk, and your husband says to you, "Look at that woman, how beautiful she is," immediately there is trouble. He cannot say it. Nothing is wrong in it. In fact, you should be happy that your husband is still alive and sane. That his tires are not flat yet. You should be happy that he is lively, young. His eyes can still see beauty. He can still be sensitive to all that is beautiful. There is no need to feel jealous. But the husband cannot say it. In fact, he will pretend that he has not looked at the other woman at all. He has looked. He is looking. He may be using sunglasses only for that purpose. He will find excuses to look at the woman. He may start talking about the beautiful tree. He is not concerned with the tree, but the woman is sitting under the tree. And the wife knows perfectly well that why he is suddenly interested in the tree. He is never interested in the tree. The wife cannot say to the husband that this man looks so beautiful. The husband will feel offended. His ego is hurt. Everybody carries this idea that nobody is more beautiful than me. Now everybody knows that this is sheer nonsense. Everybody is unique, that is true. But everybody has few things that nobody else has. Maybe this man has more beautiful eyes than you have. You may be having a beautiful nose and his nose is ugly. But what about the eyes? You may be having a beautiful face, but what about his whole proportionate body? People should be more intelligent, and they should appreciate. They should help each other to appreciate. They should say to each other that you are right, that woman looks beautiful, that man looks beautiful, and there is nothing wrong in it. And it is not going to destroy all love. It is really enhancing it, strengthening it. To communicate with each other so authentically is always a nourishment for love. Whenever you start pretending, whenever you are forced to pretend, whenever you are forced to say something which you don't want to say, and you are not allowed to say something which you wanted to say, then love starts disappearing. Then distance is created. Please help your husband to be alive again. Help him to be sane again. Help him to be sensitive again. You must have contributed much for his dullness. This is not good. This is not healthy. This is a stage of pathology. If he says that he has never thought of another woman in his life, then remember perfectly well that you are also a woman. Nothing more, nothing less. Just by becoming a wife, you are not more than a woman. And if he has no more interest in any woman, and this earth is full of beautiful women, then he has nothing to do with you either. Then he is finished with you. Or maybe you have forced him to be finished with you. That's why you say, I cannot believe it, although it is true. You cannot believe it because you must be thinking of other men. How can you believe it? If you are still thinking of other men, how can you believe that your husband is not thinking of other women? In fact, whenever a man and a woman, particularly husband and wife, are making love, then in the bed there are never only two men. There are always four. He is thinking of some other woman, and the woman is thinking of some other man. The woman is thinking of Muhammad Ali. He is thinking of Sophia Loren. And then things go good. It is always good for wives and husbands not to make love in the daytime. And even in the night, always to put the light off. So you can have free imagination. You can think of whomsoever you want to think. In fact, there is not much difference. Basically, there is not much difference. Different models. Little differences in the bonnets, etc. But basically, there is not much difference. When you come to the fundamentals, it is the same. And when you are making love to a woman or a man, you have come to the fundamentals. You have come to the very rock bottom. Now there is no more to go. And this is good about nature, that about fundamentals, it is very communist. Not much difference. All differences are superficial. But nothing is wrong in being interested. Help him. He needs your help. Because my own experience of thousands of couples is that it is always the woman who destroys the man. Although the man pretends to be the master, but he is not. And women are so utterly confident of their mastery that they allow him to talk about his mastery. They don't bother about it. They say, you can say it. That's a good division. You talk about it. That freedom is given to you. And we are the real masters. One day I went to see Mulla Nasruddin. He was sitting under his bed. I asked Nasruddin, "What is the matter? Why are you sitting under your bed?" He said, "Why not? I am the master of the house. I can sit anywhere." And then his wife came and he said, "You coward, you come out and I will show you who is the master." He said, "Nobody can force me to come out." I am the master, so I can sit anywhere I like. Now the wife is very fat and she cannot go under the bed. So I asked the wife, "What you are going to do now?" He said, "You wait. The lunch time is coming closer. He will have to come out. And under the bed, he can go on talking about his mastery. Over the bed, I know who is the master." Help your poor husband. You must have destroyed him. Not knowingly, unknowingly. Feminine strategies are very subtle. Revive him. Bring him back from his grave. And only then he will be interested in you. And he will be grateful to you. All couples should remember it, that by becoming a couple, you are not becoming masters of each other, just companions, friends. And don't take your relationship for granted. It is nothing to do with possessiveness. The man or the woman are not things to possess. They are people. They have to be respected. They are not means to be used. Husbands are using wives as means. Wives are using husbands as means. And that's why the whole world seems to be so ugly and so insane. And everybody seems to be so miserable. There is no need for so much misery. 99% of it is our creation. 1%, of course, will remain, because there are limitations of the body. The body has to become old. Sometimes it will be ill. Someday it has to die. But that is only 1%. And if 99% misery can disappear, that 1% can be accepted, joyously accepted. There is no problem about it. The fourth question. I have heard from many sannyasins that we need to do nothing at all. Let Bhagwan do it. Gurdjieff has taught that only through one's own efforts, is stemming from a deep wish, does an awareness of being grow. Please speak on this for a sannyasin suffering growing pains. Anubhuti. I know you are not suffering growing pains, not at all. because you are not growing. Anubhuti has been in Gurdjieff's work for many years, not with Gurdjieff himself, but somebody who has been with Gurdjieff. Now, to be with a master is a totally different matter. If you had been with Gurdjieff, your understanding about Gurdjieff would have been totally different. But you have never been with a living Gurdjieff. You have been with somebody who has been with Gurdjieff. And that somebody is not yet enlightened. That somebody is in the same boat as you are. But the person Anubhuti has been with, she has conditioned your mind in a certain way. Her own understanding of Gurdjieff. The people who understood Gurdjieff the most, Gurdjieff used to say even they have not understood him. Even a man like P.D. Ouspensky was rejected by Gurdjieff. In fact, the whole credit goes to P.D. Ouspensky of making Gurdjieff world famous. Nobody would have known about him without Ouspensky. It is through Ouspensky's books that Gurdjieff became well known. He may have died an obscure mystic. It was Ouspensky and his great capacity to philosophize, to argument, to write, that made Gurdjieff one of the greatest known masters of the world. But Gurdjieff was not happy even with Ouspensky's understanding about him. He used to say that Ouspensky has misunderstood me totally. And Ouspensky was, of course, very angry. And finally he departed from Gurdjieff and became antagonistic. Even to mention Gurdjieff's name in Ouspensky's presence was an offense. No disciple of Ouspensky was allowed to mention Gurdjieff's name, although what Ouspensky was teaching was Gurdjieff's teaching, according to him. And if you read Ouspensky and Gurdjieff, you will be more convinced with Ouspensky than with Gurdjieff. Because Gurdjieff is not a philosopher. He is not a good writer either. His writing is so tedious, so boring, that if you can finish his whole book, that will show great willpower. I have come across many people who have been deeply interested in Gurdjieff, but they have not read his books. They all have read Ouspensky, Nicole, and others. Whatsoever you know about Gurdjieff is not about Gurdjieff. You don't know anything about him. Even the people who lived with him for many years were not capable to understand him. He was a very mysterious man. And to each disciple he was saying different things. Because each disciple's need is different. He said one thing to Ouspensky and another thing to Nicole. Just the opposite of it. Because their needs were so different that the same thing cannot be said to them. To few people he said, surrender everything to me. It happened once. A very rich Russian woman came to him. And the first thing he asked, you surrender all your valuable ornaments to me immediately. If you want to be my disciple, give all your diamonds and jewels. And she had really beautiful things with her. She was one of the richest women of those days. She became very afraid. Naturally, she went in her room to think over it, what to do. Is it right to surrender everything? She was sharing the room with another woman, her one of old acquaintances. She was also rich. She asked about the matters. What to do? The other woman said, there is no problem. The same thing happened with me. When I came, he asked me, give all your valuables to me first. If you cannot sacrifice that much, then forget all about me and my work. Then your search is not authentic. You have to pay for it. And I immediately surrendered then and there all my ornaments. And do you know what happened? The woman said, next morning he came to my room and gave everything back to me. So the new woman was very much happy. She went and surrendered everything and Gurdjieff never came back. She waited and waited and she asked the other woman, what is the matter? He has not come back. The woman said, I don't know what is the matter. But with me that has happened. I don't know why he is not coming. The woman became very distrustful, left Gurdjieff, started spreading rumors about him, that man is a charlatan, that he is exploiting people. The other woman asked Gurdjieff, why you returned everything to me and not to her? Gurdjieff said, you surrendered so immediately without a thought, there was no need to keep it. She thought over it. She asked you about it. When she was certain that things will be returned to her, then only she gave it to me. That was not surrender at all. That was calculation. And I don't want calculative people around me. If I had returned those things to her, she would have stayed here. So I have killed two birds with one stone. We have got that much money. We needed it for the work. And we got rid of that stupid woman. And now she is spreading rumors about me, so other stupid people won't come to me. You are not going through growing pains. You are simply in a confusion. Because my work is totally different than Gurdjieff's work. It is bound to be so. Your problem is now what to do. Anubhuti has entered into many groups and left every group because it does not fit with her understanding of work. It is below her. She knows far better. She has worked for years. But my work is totally different. Gurdjieff depended on crystallization. And my work is dissolution. You have to dissolve, not to crystallize. Both are valid means. From both the doors you can enter the ultimate. Either you have to enter through willpower, and that was Gurdjieff's work, or you have to enter through surrender. That is my work. You ask me, please speak on this for a sannyasin suffering growing pains. You are just trying to understand me with your Gurdjieffian jargon. That won't work. If you want to understand me, you will have to put Gurdjieff aside. I love the man. I love him immensely. I respect the man. But my ways are totally different. But old habits die hard. An American teacher is tired of seeing her white students fight with the black ones who are forbidden to use the school bus. So one day she calls them together and says, "Boys, what are all these discriminations? I won't have any of this. Remember, we are all equal. Everybody is equal, black or white. So from now on, we can think of ourselves as blue. Have you understood? We are all blue. And now, the light blues will go on the bus, and the dark blues will go on foot." Old habits. Heaven is in a havoc. God asks St. Peter the reason for it, and St. Peter replies, "Well, it is that man, Adolf Hitler. He is impossible. He keeps shouting at everyone, 'Jew, Jew.' But do not worry, I will tackle him myself." After a while, peace and harmony reign in heaven again. Curious, God asks St. Peter, "How did you do it?" "Well, it was easy," says St. Peter. "I just gave him a brush, and now, instead of shouting, 'Jew, Jew,' he is busy writing 'Jew' on all the clouds." Old habits. You have come here. You have waited here to come for months, You have longed to be here. You have disappointed your so-called teachers. You have disappointed your whole group. But you are not here either. You are neither there nor here. You are in a limbo. If you want to work according to Gurdjieff, escape from here as quickly as possible. If you want to work according to me, then you will have to learn different ways. You ask, I have heard from many sannyasins, that we need to do nothing at all. That is the most difficult thing in the world, to do nothing at all. Don't think it is the easier way. It is the most difficult thing, nothing to do. You can do anything. The problem arises when you are told not to do anything. Sitting silently, doing nothing. The spring comes and the grass grows by itself. Gurdjieff's work is work. My work is not work, it is play. And there is a great difference between the two. Gurdjieff will like you to force yourself to the extreme. He was a hard taskmaster. I don't want you to be extremists. I want you to be exactly in the middle. I want you to be exactly in the middle. Remember it, because only through that balance is possible. Equilibrium is possible. You are not asked to do anything at all. You say, and your sannyasins say, let Bhagwan do it. I don't do anything at all. That is just a way of saying, I am not doing anything, and I want my sannyasins not to do anything either. But their old habits are there. So I tell them, you leave it to me, I will do. I don't do anything at all. I have never done anything in my life. I am the laziest man you can find in the world. Can't you see I don't even walk 100 yards? And I have told Lakshmi in the new place, the car has to come on top of the stage. I am the laziest person in the world. Why bother these steps? I don't do anything. But my sannyasins are accustomed of doing. So just to help them, that you don't be worried, I will do. You leave it to me. That is just an excuse for them to leave doing. And then things start happening on their own. I want you to be natural. Gurdjieff's work is extremist. It creates tension in you. It depends on friction. It creates friction in you. My work is not work. It is relaxation. It is rest. It is becoming more and more silent. Utterly silent. Even if you are doing something, you are not to be the doer of it. You have not to take it seriously. Gurdjieff's work is serious. My work is not serious at all. It is playfulness. It is fun. It is dance. It is song. I don't call it work. Work is a dirty word. 4-letter dirty word here. But you are misunderstanding me for the simple reason because you have your own understanding. Either you will have to drop your understanding that you are carrying with yourself, or you will have to drop me. You will have to choose. You cannot ride on these two horses. A beautiful looking tomcat is strolling down the road. On the way to the park, he meets a little white tomcat. "Hey, Tommy, where are you going?" asks the little cat. "I'm going to the park to fuck around," answers big Tommy. "What is that?" "Something like fish," asks the little one. "Come with me and you will find out," says Tommy. Soon the two tomcats come to the big fountain in the park, and there sits Jolly, the most beautiful cat in town, her golden fur shining in the sun. She sees the big tomcat coming closer with a mischievous smile on his cat face. "I am in trouble," she exclaims, jumps up and starts running around the fountain. "Come on, boy," cries Tommy. And he starts running after her. One round, two rounds, three rounds. "Come on faster," Tommy screams. Round and round the fountain they run. The little white cat, hardly keeping up with Tommy, exhausted, gasping for air, trembling on his little legs, cries, "Hey, Tommy, listen. I will fuck one more round and that's enough for me." You say Gurdjieff has taught that only through one's own efforts, stemming from a deep wish, does an awareness of being grow. That is true. But then you have to follow the whole Gurdjieffian method. And for that you will need a Gurdjieff. Without a Gurdjieff, it is impossible to do it. Without a living master, no method, however beautiful it is, works. In fact, it is the master, his presence, that is the real thing, not the methods. With a alive master, everything works. With a dead master, nothing works. Let it be settled forever in your consciousness. That's why beautiful methods later on are found to be bogus. It is not the methods, it is the master, it is the man behind. It is the golden touch, the magical touch of the master. It is his charisma that works. When I am gone, then Sufi dancing will continue and there will be Kundalini. And there will be chaotic meditation, and all things will continue in the same routine way, but something will be missing. Something which was the very soul of them. then they will be just rituals. That's how Christian church goes on, Hindus go on, Mohammedans go on, Buddhists go on. And these methods did work once. They worked when Jesus was alive. They worked when Krishna was alive. They worked when Buddha was alive. Being with a living master is what works. It is not the method. That's the difference between science and religion. Religion is magic. Science depends on method. Religion depends on masters, on the prajñas of those who have become awakened. Here, if you can get attuned with me, only then something is possible. Even the impossible is possible, but you will have to get attuned with me. Gurdjieff will be a hindrance. If you choose Gurdjieff, choose Gurdjieff. But remember, you are choosing a dead master. You can go on repeating his methods your whole life. Nothing is going to happen through them. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.